Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World interview recorded on the 1st of September 2021, and I'm your host Tamsin Freeman, and today we're going to get an insight into investing in the mining sector. Now, I never invest in mining, but with inflation and resources used in electrification and the demand of new technologies, I really wanted to understand how to evaluate mining stocks. And I was introduced to Richard Greenfield from Tamasis Partners, who are an advisory house in the mining sector. And Richard very kindly volunteered to give us his overview of how to evaluate mining investments. Richard, thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and Tamasis Partners?
Yeah, thanks, Tamsin, and thanks for having me. So in terms of my own background, I'm actually originally an accountant by training. Started my career in the early 2000s with PwC, quite quickly moved across into the banking space with various firms, but really focused almost entirely on the mining sector since around 2005, 2006, with a firm called Ambrian Partners to start with, which was a mining-focused house. And then latterly with a group called GMP, which was a pretty globally significant brokerage house headquartered in Canada, but with presence in London where I worked, but also Australia. So very much a global operation focused on the sector. That's now part of the investment bank Stifel. And I founded Tamasis with partners almost exactly 5 years ago. We've just turned 5 years old, actually, as a business, which is a nice milestone to meet. And so Tamasis is really a purely mining-focused boutique middle and investment bank. So that covers corporate broking for companies in the UK, but also overseas, a lot of Australian and Canadian companies in particular, obviously capital raising and then advisory transactions. So that's M&A or, you know, a lot of work with private equity groups that focus on the space. And then in terms of the wider partnership, our research efforts are headed by a gentleman called David Butler, who's a very experienced analyst, possibly the most experienced analyst actually in the London mining space. He used to run research for Cazenove, JP Morgan, and then latterly Barclays. Charlie Benden, who heads our sales efforts and, you know, similar to me, is focused on the sector, I think, for around 20 years. In his case, the last 15 of those would be alongside myself. A gentleman called Mitch Lim, who's another investment banker, came across with me from GMP. And the majority of our team are actually technically qualified to some degree, so either geologists or mining engineers, and have actually worked on mine sites and for mining companies, which we hope gives us a bit of an edge in the space.
So starting at the beginning, what's the composition of the global metals and mining industry?
Yeah, so you know, obviously it's a global industry and a pretty broad church. When people think of mining, you know, that can mean the whole suite of commodities. So and they all have different drivers, of course. But if you want to simplify, we would split it into really three, or I suppose now four, kind of main groups, being the precious metals. That's your golds, silver, your platinum group metals. Your base metals, the likes of copper, nickel, zinc, and then your bulk materials, so your steel commodities, iron ore, aluminium, coal, obviously falling out of favor these days. But you know, increasingly, people talk about battery metals, so that's your lithiums, cobalts, graphites, etc. That's currently quite a small component, actually, of the industry. There's a pie chart on the slide there, which breaks out the industry by revenues, and you know, batteries would be a small component currently, but growing very quickly. And it's an interesting space at the time because you've got commodities that were thought about as pure base metals or industrial commodities, likes of copper, nickel are increasingly important in the battery space as we move through this electrification dynamic and decarbonisation. So yeah, it's been an interesting space, and will get more interesting in the years to come, no doubt.
And how much is London listed, and how much is rest of the world?
Yeah, so there are really, we would say there are three main sort of hubs of the global mining space in terms of where companies are listed, London being one of those. Two biggest markets would probably be the Australian Stock Exchange and the Toronto Stock Exchange. So London's a significant market. It is definitely dominated by the larger mining companies, so the Rios, BHPs, Glencores of the world, which are all listed here. So it's a significant industry in its own right in the London space. In terms of number of companies, there are many more companies listed in Australia and Toronto. We've got on the slide there, London in total has something like 155 mining companies, from the largest down to the smallest. By comparison, there's nearly 700 in Australia and over 1,000 in Toronto. So when we're looking at the industry, we very much look at it in a global perspective. If we're looking for a lithium project or a copper project, you've got to be benchmarking those across the global exchanges. And there's some very good practice in those other markets. I think we could learn quite a lot, actually, from the way that companies comply and report in those other markets. We've been quite active in bringing companies across, actually, to London. So we've dual-listed quite a number of companies over the years, recent ones that spring to mind, the likes of Adriatic Metals, which has got a very attractive project in Bosnia, came across from Australia. Pure Gold, it's a Canadian gold producer. A little bit further back, Tharisa, some people may know, is a chrome and platinum company from South Africa. Mod Resources, which was a good copper company from Australia, very quickly got taken over.
So where are we in the cycle, and where should we be looking to make money in the current climate?
So it's generally been a very good time in the mining space. We arguably got something of a COVID bounce, if I can say that. With hindsight, some of the drivers for that can look quite obvious. Inflation coming in and some of the stimulus that governments have come through with. But I would say we didn't necessarily know that at the time, but people who got onto that train early have done very well. The commodities themselves are generally trading at quite nice prices versus their longer term ranges. I've got there a spread of commodities: gold, copper, zinc is two of the base metals, with nickel and iron ore. And you can see that generally those commodities are trading, while not necessarily close to all-time highs, they're trading nicely above their longer term averages. So generally, if you've got a mining project or a mine that's in production and you're not making money at these levels, I would consider that a problem. Most operations should be doing quite well at these sort of prices. And what's interesting is we're at a time where the industrial commodities are trading well, at a time where the precious metals commodities are also trading well. Often you'd expect those to go counter-cyclical. You often invest in the industrial commodities at times of growth, tap into that global growth, whereas you might look at the precious metals, particularly gold, at times of recession as something of a hedge against that uncertainty. But we're at a time now where generally the commodity suite as a whole is performing well. What's interesting is that while it's a good time, I would say that the equities haven't necessarily fully followed the commodities themselves. I've got on the chart there the gold price, but also the GDXJ, which is the index of gold producers, and the commodity has definitely outperformed the equities there over the last few years. And of course, the broader market has done very well. Clearly, we're on the back of broadly a decade-long bull cycle in general equities. The mining equities, whilst they've done well in the last year or two, are certainly laggards versus the broader market. So it's still potentially an opportunity for people. And I think, you know, it is important to recognize that while the commodities have performed strongly, there are big drivers for that, which we'll come onto and which one might expect to continue for the next little while.
Why have the equities lagged?
They should probably lag to some degree. You know, obviously, you know, it is a cyclical industry, so you should never price in when prices are good for that to continue forever, and the same follows when the prices are weak. But I think fundamentally, we're probably coming off a period. We obviously had a very big boom through the early 2000s, which then quickly turned into the bust with the credit crisis. I think probably, you know, institutions and people that invest in the space have just been a little bit wary of this time, and just wanting to see prices sustained before really giving full credit for it in the equities possibly.
So commodities are fairly highly priced at the moment. Are we imagining that will endure, and what are the main drivers for that to happen?
Yeah, so although they're relatively highly priced versus perhaps some of the longer term average, they have pulled back a little bit. But I think there are big systemic drivers that would suggest that this would continue for some time. You know, it's important to remember that the mining industry, in terms of its supply response, is always going to be slow. It takes a very long time to bring a new mine into production, certainly to discover one and then bring it into production. So where you have these positive demand shocks, you know, that does create quite a good environment potentially for some time. So, yeah, there are some big trends which are all really aligning. So, you know, obviously we're all familiar with quantitative easing and loose monetary policy, which has been a theme really since the credit crisis. And you know, obviously now with COVID and the government responses to that, you know, that's given a renewed energy to that that looseness, and now potentially coming through into inflation, which is obviously a big talking point in the broader market. You know, we've got the US inflation rate hitting 5.4%, at least consumer inflation recently in July. You know, so the question will be, does that then become to some degree systemic and self-fulfilling? If it does, that would be very good for commodities. Alongside monetary stimulus, you've obviously got now infrastructure stimulus, which is the other big lever that the governments are looking to pull as a response to COVID. That's one way that they can stimulate economies, and that they're certainly doing that. You hear even in the UK here, we talk about building back better and building back greener. So even in the UK, there's £100 billion infrastructure budget for 2021. You know, that doesn't really include HS2, which is, as we know, in itself is north of that figure for the capex there. You know, clearly we're a small part of the global economy. Over in the US, Biden announced a $1.2 trillion package, and China is $1.4 billion to $2.5 trillion by 2025. So those are very big numbers, and that's you know, a huge amount of metal required to bring that about. And then you've got more technologically driven themes. So electrification, you know, the energy transition, decarbonisation, the move to electric vehicles, and you know, the models are typically very poor at trying to forecast this exponential growth. So if you look at just the electric vehicle space, people are projecting a growth of 22% per annum through to 2027. You wouldn't be surprised at all if that's exceeded. You know, when these things start to move, they can often snowball, and that is very difficult to respond to. You know, we're going to need an awful lot of the likes of lithium. You know, lithium demand is due to treble by 2025. Copper, you know, Goldman's recently called copper the new oil. They're calling for copper to rise to $15,000 a ton. You know, historically, you might have thought of $6,000-$7,000 a ton as a good price. You know, you've seen things like semiconductor shortages. You know, that's a symptom of demand for computing power. That's creating all sorts of bottlenecks. Tin, you know, for example, is at a record high, near close to $35,000 a ton. You know, historically, you would have thought that $20,000 a ton would be a good price. And as I said, minds can't respond that quickly. So I would hope that we're in for a good couple of years.
So could you give us a little bit of a perspective as to how commodities and equities have moved with each other over time and where we're at in the cycle?
Sure. So I thought it was quite interesting just to take this longer term perspective as we put this together. It's quite interesting a couple of things that we looked at here. So we've got at the top of the page here a really interesting chart, which is the ratio of the broader equity market, in this case the S&P 500, to basic materials. So these are the underlying commodities rather than the equities themselves. Now what you'll see there, the first thing to point out, of course, is that equities over the long run will outperform basic materials, and that's to be expected. That's a consequence of global growth. But what you will see there, and it's interesting to look at just the times of pullbacks and reversions in that ratio. So the first thing to say is that we're currently trading at an all-time high ratio of the broader equity market to commodities. And if you look back at periods of prior volatility, you can see that they tend to be inversely correlated, and that's to do with the way that the commodities and equities will respond at different times in credit cycles. So what you'll see is that stocks tend to outperform commodities in either late recessions or early expansions, whereas your commodities, if they're going to outperform, it will tend to be when you're in a late expansion or an early recession. So if you're concerned that we might be coming towards the end of what has been quite a long-running late expansion, now is perhaps quite a good time to be taking some exposure to commodities, perhaps in equity form as a hedge against that. The bottom chart is much more straightforward. That's simply a long-dated gold price chart, and a good student of gold history recently reminded me of this, that it is this year the anniversary of the end of the Bretton Woods gold standard there in 1971, before my time, thankfully, where gold was allowed to float for the first time by the US. It came out at $35 an ounce. We're now at 1800. So conveniently, that's a broadly 50x return on the 50th anniversary. So perhaps a lesson that it doesn't necessarily pay to try too hard to time the market, but if you take a long-term view, commodities can be quite a good place to be.
Do you think that will continue to drive prices up? We're at all-time highs, but will they go beyond this, in your opinion?
Well, they've pulled back a little bit from all-time highs. I said, let's just talk about copper. If the guys at Goldman's are correct, and $15,000 a ton is where we're heading by 2025, we're only at around $9,000 a ton now. So yeah, you certainly could see prices head higher and certainly be maintained. And even if they're maintained, I would suggest that's very good for the equities. The share prices are, I would argue, discounting lower long-term prices than where we are now, for sure.
So, what is the best way for new biz to play the sector?
So I think for someone new to the sector, there's obviously a range of options. Let's just talk about what they are first before which way you might play it. Clearly you can buy just straight mining equities, and that can be anything from the majors down through to smaller companies, single asset producers, right the way down to explorers or even prospect generators. Now, if you're a new investor to the sector, you've got to be careful to be overexposed to the junior end of the market. We would always suggest that someone should be weighted primarily towards the more senior companies, although obviously there's lots of good money to be made in the junior end of the market. But you certainly want to be diversified if you're doing that. One general comment I would make is that you would observe over the years that what typically happens that early in a cycle, you want to go into bigger companies first. That's because the bigger money of the world will go into the bigger companies when they see a trend emerging. As you get later in the cycle, that can often trickle down. You know, you get M&A activity with the large companies looking to buy new sources of supply and new projects. So later in the cycle can be a good time to perhaps come a little bit down the market cap spectrum. We've got royalty companies here, which we'll probably talk to a little bit more detail later on. And that could be quite a good way, I think, for someone who's newer to the sector to play it. We'll discuss in more detail later, but broadly, they're earning a percentage of mining turnover rather than being exposed to the cost line. So they can be less volatile. They're generally more diversified for their for a relative scale. So it gives you exposure to those trends without some of the risks. You know, obviously, you've got ETFs and funds. Now, you know, you can buy the commodities themselves in an ETF format. You can buy a gold ETF. You could buy lots of other commodities via ETFs if you want to get exposure to a particular commodity. It's worth just talking about why someone might buy an equity versus just buying the underlying commodity. Generally, over time, the equities would outperform a commodity versus the basic material for a couple of reasons. You've got operational leverage in there. So, you know, if the gold price were to, and this would be lovely, but if the gold price were to double, you know, you would normally see 2x there or thereabouts on average, you know, the impact on the bottom line of a mining company. So that's just the amount of performance there. And then they can create money in other ways, either through exploration, or their capital programs. Obviously, they can pay you a dividend, which the commodity can't, and accretive M&A. So, you know, there are good reasons to buy the equities over the commodities if you believe in the upcycle. There are good exchange traded funds. You know, particularly if you want to play the gold space. I think as a newbie, you know, it's a very sensible thing to do to just go and buy the GDX or its junior equivalent, which is the GDXJ, still quite senior companies there. And of course, you've got active fund managers. You know, a couple here that people might come across would be, you know, there's a good fund at what used to be Investec, now 91, run by George Cheevy. Some very good funds there for investors. Or the BlackRock team, Tom Hold and his colleagues do a very good job. And then you've got service providers. Again, I think this is a good way for perhaps newer investors to get exposure to the sector. It's something of a derivative play. They always say that the people who made the money out of the you know, the gold rush were the people who provided the picks and shovels. So this is really that thematic. So that's equipment providers, you know, your drillers, mining services companies. So you know, that's a low risk way to play the space too.
So if you're looking at a mine, when do you want to get into it? When do you want to start investing in a mine?
Well, this really depends what it is that you're looking for in your investment. And I'd just like to differentiate a little bit between, you know, maybe it's not the right words, but between, you know, pure investment and more speculation. So, you know, and what I mean by that is the more senior you're going, so if you're invested in a producer or a large diversified producer, you know, you're getting much more of your return there through the commodity exposure. If you're at the other end of the spectrum, earlier stage exploration, then that's what you might term more speculation, in that you are speculating on the outcome of questions. You know, will a company find a resource? Will that resource be large enough? Will it be economically mineable? So it depends on what you're looking for through that spectrum. You very much need to be aware of what it is that you're gaining exposure to there. You know, if you are looking for pure commodity exposure, you should be looking at the more senior companies. If you are looking for that value creation by de-risking, then, you know, obviously some explorers, developers would be where you're looking. We've got on the slide here, this is often referred to as the Lassonde curve. So this is named after Pierre Lassonde, who's a very famous, well-renowned investor manager in our space, and was the founder of the royalty company Franco-Nevada. And one thing I would point out here, he observed that you get this S curve. So you obviously get value creation as you have success going through the development curve. One time that can be tricky is once you're going through the construction phase, because at that point, companies can sometimes lack news flow. Construction is obviously a risky time to be going through. And so that can be an uncomfortable time to be invested in a miner. But it always comes down to relative risking and relative pricing. So you've got to be watching, watching your watch list, seeing where companies are versus fair value, and pulling the trigger if you're comfortable.
It seems to me that the least risky stage is the production stage. Do you really want to be in at the speculative and development stages?
Well, we'll look at a few situations later where that can go very well. You can make multiple returns if you're invested in a good project early on, which can be a good place to be. Clearly, I just think you need to be diversified. If you're doing that, and you also need to be comfortable of what you're buying and what risks you're taking through doing that. I would always be a little bit nervous if someone came to me and said, Richard, I want exposure, let's say, to the gold space. Here is one gold explorer that I've been pitched. Is that the best thing to do? I would say no. If you're going to do that, you should be having a spread of those projects, and you should really be looking to work with someone who can differentiate those projects and hopefully weed out the ones that will be more likely to be successful on that journey, because there is a lot of risk at that phase.
So what makes a good mine, and how do you value it?
So all mines are different, clearly. A gold mine will look very different to an iron ore mine, for example. But there are sort of key components that one can look at that make a mining project. But even within the commodities themselves, they all have their own challenges to be addressed, and they'll all have their differences. But broadly, you've got these same components. So clearly, fundamentally, you're starting with an ore body. Is that an open pit ore body, or is it an underground ore body? And they can be quite different. People would generally perceive underground mining to be a little bit riskier than open pit mining, and certainly on a like-for-like basis can be higher cost. So what is the grade of that ore body? It often surprises people just to learn how much material you have to move to recover commodities. Just take gold, a decent or a good open pit gold grade, for example, might be 2 grams per ton, and then that's the ore body itself. That's before you start moving waste. That often surprises people. On an underground mine, it might be perhaps 5 grams per ton, for example. So when you're looking at an ore body, obviously grade is key. They say grade is king. If you've got a high grade deposit, that means you need to move much less material to recover the same amount of the commodity. You'll also have typically a smaller processing plant, so you'll be lower cost, lower capex. But that's not the only driver. You've also got to look at stripping ratios, how much waste you have to move to get to that ore, for example. And then you've got your processing plant. Can you recover metal successfully? Some ore bodies are just easier to process and lower cost to process than others. Do you have hard ore? Do you need to use lots of reagents to recover it? And then you've got infrastructure. So mines are huge consumers of power. If you have a mine which is off-grid, maybe using diesel generation for its power, that's going to be very much higher cost than if you are on-grid. Maybe if you're lucky next to a hydroelectric plant, you might be looking at a spread of, let's say, 5 cents per kilowatt hour, right up to 35, 40 cents per kilowatt hour if you're in a remote area. On diesel makes a big difference. Logistics, if you are a bulk, particularly if you're a bulk materials mine, that's all about logistics. If you've got a good iron ore deposit, but you are 500 kilometers from the coast in the African jungle, very, very different to being next to a port, absolutely critical to your cost base. One thing I would highlight is just getting away from the technicals, people. Your first filter, I would suggest, would always be people. So good assets generally go with good people. Before they've come to something, somebody like me, projects have gone through management teams, and if it's been brought to you by a good management team that's had success in the past, that's a very good sign. That's your first filter. They also say that mines are made, not found. lot of problem solving here. Good people will look at challenges, and you know, if they can be made to work, they will make them work. Whereas if you've got bad people, you know, you can very quickly make a mess of a good deposit. So that's the first thing that anyone should look at. And then you've got financial factors. Just like any other business, you want to be invested in companies with good balance sheets. You know, you don't have dilution pending. It's a risky sector. Commodity prices can go up and down. Well-capitalized companies will generally trade at premiums to more thinly capitalized companies. And then you've got things like political risk. And that's not confined to difficult bits of Africa. You know, you can have wealth taxes, resources taxes coming in, you know, in the best of jurisdictions. Even Australia had a royalty tax issue not so long back.
And what is a good operating margin in mining?
We tend to look at this, we look at it from a cost base perspective, which is a really central dynamic. So we've got here on the slide, you know, some of the metrics that go into making a good mine. The position on the cash cost curve, which is what you've got there at the bottom of slide, is critical. You know, if you can, you want to be looking at something that would be in the bottom one or two quartiles there. Generally, if you're in there, you're going to be making money through most cycles. You can get times where almost everybody is losing money, or as we are now, most people are making money. But generally, if you can try and find something that's at that point on the cost curve, you'd be making a good margin. You know, if I look at gold producers now, gold prices are $1,800 an ounce, thereabouts. You know, a good mine, you know, all in cash costs might be about $1,000 an ounce, thereabouts, and it would be similar sorts of margins in most commodities. So that's a key metric. The other things we're looking for when we're screening projects, you know, let's work backwards. You're looking for something that's going to give you a good net present value as a sort of key valuation metric, certainly for a project. You know, obviously the higher the better, but you know, you want that to be meaningful, you know, just like any other business. Particularly at the moment, it's very key that you've got something that's of sufficient scale to attract an institutional audience. Or another way, obviously, to make money in our sector is to prove a project and then sell it to a bigger operator. Again, you know, bigger companies tend to buy projects that are meaningful. And then, of course, your IRR or internal rate of return is a key driver. You know, typically, you want to be, again, higher the better, but you want to be looking at north of 20% there for a project to be, you know, worthy of or deserving of capital. And then you can start looking at the equity valuation that goes on that. But just like any other businesses, you're looking at CapEx, margins, returns.
So it strikes me as a higher risk area. So what are the potential returns and what's the success rate like?
So the success rate will depend on your stage of development. The stats out there which suggest, you know, I think if you go right the way back to sort of target generation, something like 1 in 300 targets will ever become a mine. Thankfully, by the time you're looking at something in the public space, you should be a long way on from that. You know, generally, as a house, we're focused more on things that are either post, you know, initial resource, or certainly with good visibility on that and on their way through to proving the economics. So at that point, the success rate you know, is a lot higher. I'm not sure I want to put a percentage on it, because again, it just depends on where you are, but you know, much higher. But yes, clearly with a lot of risk. You know, we've put here a couple of examples of where we've made, you know, really good returns in the sector in different ways. So the first two companies at the top here, so that's Adriatic Metals, a TSS listed company, or was called GT Gold Corporation. Those are both really good examples of early stage exploration success, and you can see the returns there. So Adriatic has been a really good, quite quick success story. So that listed initially on the Australian Stock Exchange, I think it was 2018, at 20 cents a share. It's today, I think, around $2.90 Australian, so, you know, 14.5 times return there. You know, that had some good historical data to go on, but they very quickly hit something of a bonanza draw result and followed that up with good exploration success. And, you know, obviously that's been a great story to be involved with all the way through. We're now actually going through the construction project financing round for that. And that's been great to go from listing to construction financing in, you know, around 3 years is exceptionally quick. So Paul Cronin, CEO there, and his team have done really well. GT Gold was another early stage one, probably earlier stage than we would usually get involved with. But that was an example, again, where people being your first filter, it piqued our attention. It was just starting exploration, but a gentleman called Ross Beattie had come in there as a shareholder, very good track record over in Canada. So, you know, we got involved in one of the early rounds there. It was eventually taken out only about three years later by Newmont. Return from listing to take over there was just over 19 times. That doesn't include, I think, people who participated in that first round were actually given warrants alongside their shares. So I think actually including the warrants, the return might have been more like 25 wow. times. So phenomenal. Does also remind you need to hold on to your winners in our sector, because you know they do have to support the ones that don't go so well. But clearly that, you know, those sort of returns are going to support a lot that don't go as well. And the bottom two companies here, they're quite different different plays. So they're much later stage investments. So Alphamin is a tin company. You know, listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange. As we spoke about earlier, tin has been a really good place to be, and I think will continue to be a really good place to be. But that also experienced, as we spoke earlier, on the curve, a little bit of a speed bump during its construction phase. Now, the team had done really well there. You know, Alphamin is a phenomenal deposit. It's about a 4% tin ore body, where sort of 0.5% to 1% would generally be a good tin grade, but it's in a difficult part of the DRC, the Congo over in Africa. So delivering a project there is not easy. They had to do a small top-up round along the way, but once that was done, you know, it was very much sort of cleared for takeoff. That's up over 5x since around this time last year, so that's been really good. You know, another one we had great success with a bit further back, a company called Mineral Deposits, that's a integrated mineral sands mine in Senegal, smelter in Norway, had a joint venture partner there with Eramet of France. Similarly, we got involved in a small recap there a couple of years ago, and you know, once that was out of the way, it was pretty much one-way traffic until it was eventually taken over by that joint venture partner, Eramet, for more than a 4x return, I think in about 15 months from memory. So those are good examples of where you've got companies that are going through that construction phase or even early production, just watching the balance sheet. You know, if it's looking thin, maybe being a bit wary, but once that's resolved, it can be a really good time to invest in the money.
So what are the risks that we need to look out for?
Yeah, we have this question here, what could possibly go wrong? Which is a question we have often asked ourselves. The slightly glib answer to that is almost everything. We had some discussion amongst the team, actually putting this together earlier in the week, and just looking at things that had gone wrong with projects. And it's a pretty long list, you know, everything from projects where you found rare plant species and can't go forward, right through to things like Ebola. But, you know, seriously, you know, it's an industry which is all about managing risk and safety, clearly, you know, key concerns. But yeah, there are inherent challenges which you can't get away from, no matter how well you know, you're doing your job or management teams are doing their job. Geology, you know, it's not an exact science. You know, a miner will tell you they're always learning about their ore bodies as they're mining. Even, you know, you can get a surprise there. Grade's not what you think it is. Maybe it peters out. Maybe you get a fault, you know, your grade can be lower than you thought. You know, these risks reduce generally as you go through development. So once you've crossed into the production stage, you know, you've mitigated by that point a lot of your risks, but they don't go away. You know, you can have safety issues, you know, weather issues. It could be infrastructure you're reliant on from third parties can fail. Lots of things can go wrong. You know, political and social risk, you know, critical to a mine, you know, maintaining your social license to operate. You know, again, a good operator will make sure that that's tightly managed, but, you know, can't control everything outside of its control. You know, you've got at the extreme end, you can have war, you know, you can have civil unrest, you know, obviously strikes, all those sorts of issues, political changes, government changes. As I said earlier, fiscal regime can quite easily change. And then you've got commodity prices. You know, commodity prices are inherently cyclical. They will go up and down. All you can really do is to mitigate that risk, again, by being invested in good quality projects, bottom end of the cost curve. If you can, make sure that you're looking at something that's got a strong balance sheet. You know, if you're looking at a mine which is burdened by a lot of debt, yeah, or maybe hedging arrangements, you know, that's inherently riskier than something that's financed primarily with equity. So yeah, you've got to do what you can to mitigate your risk, but you know, always come back to you've got to diversify.
Mm-hmm. So what are your top picks at the moment? What are you looking at and what should we be putting on our radar to do more research on?
Yeah, so we talked about three companies, which we'll go through in a minute. The first one of those is a royalty company. As I said earlier, I think royalties and royalty and streaming companies are a really good way for a generalist investor to get exposure to the space. So, you know, royalties is big business in the mining sector. You know, some of the bigger players, the likes of Franco, it's a $27 billion company these days. Wheaton, which recently listed in London, that's about a $20 billion company. And this is just like royalty businesses in other sectors. People will be familiar with music and film royalties. And what you're getting there is a percentage of turnover. So that's good because you're getting exposure to commodity prices. You're also getting exposure to things like exploration success. But what you're not getting exposure to is the cost base or any capex spend. You'll benefit from it, but you won't pay for that, so you don't face dilution. So fundamentally, if a mine operates, the royalty will pay. So that's a lower risk space to be. They're also senior in the capital structure, often secured, including on land. So even some jurisdictions through bankruptcy processes, your royalties can be maintained. So you know, clearly a much lower risk proposition. And it's been a highly successful space. If you look at the chart there, you've got the three largest royalty companies, so Franco, Wheaton, Royal Gold. These are all precious metals focused companies. That's the heart of the royalties industry in the mining space. That's only where it grew from. And you can see that they've outperformed their the miners. So we've got the GDXJ index, which we talked about earlier. Those companies in the longer term have significantly outperformed the miners and with a lower risk. So it's been quite a good space to be. Another feature is that as they grow, they tend to create value through that growth for a couple of reasons. One, as scale is added, they're more diversified, their risk is reduced, and so naturally the market should attribute a lower discount rate to that. But also their overheads remain very low. So a large royalty company may have really quite a small staff base, so the overheads won't grow with the size of the portfolio. So again, that's good for value. All of this means that these can trade at quite high valuation multiples, but then that persists. So the big companies will often trade as much as 2x net present value. So that's what you can achieve if you're successful in this space. So boiling that down then to stocks, the first one I want to talk about is a royalty business, which is a company called Trident Royalties, and that's listed in London on AIM. The ticker is TRR. Now that's a relatively new royalty company. So it listed on AIM in June 2020, actually raised its money, I think March, April of that year, which was right at the heart of COVID. So quite a good achievement to get that done at that point. But it's growing very quickly. It listed at that point, market cap would have been around $25 million. They've now grown it to $85 million or thereabouts. So it's now on that journey where it's adding scale. And as I said, that's a good place to be for an investor. It's got that nice left to right upward share price chart generally. Small pullback in the last month or so, which can be a good opportunity. The directors have been buying recently in quite some size, so again, that gives confidence. Now they're doing a few things a little bit differently. So as I mentioned, the sector has been really dominated by precious metals peers. So we track something like 20 royalty companies. Of those, I think 15 or so would be exclusively or mainly focused on precious metals. And of the balance, a couple are really single asset royalty companies. Whereas what Trident's looking to do is to mirror the global sector. So right where we started, if you break the industry down broadly, a third precious metals, a third base, and then a third bulks, battery, other commodities. That's what Trident's trying to replicate. So in a single share, but from a royalty perspective, almost like a ETF, eventually ETF type approach, but actively managed to create that portfolio. Probably the nearest peer that people will be familiar with here will be Anglo Pacific, which has a long history. Trident's similar, but more growth focused, I would say, than Anglo-Pac, certainly growing more quickly at the moment. It also doesn't do coal. Clearly, Anglo-Pac has got quite a significant coal exposure, and Trident does precious, which I don't think is really a focus for Anglo-Pac. So they create value by acquiring royalties either through primary financing, so funding new developments for a company, or in the secondary market. Both are big opportunities, we believe. Clearly, there's a lot of money that's going to be required in the sector to deliver the growth we need in supply, to fund this energy transition and other trends. So that'll be royalties are an increasingly important part of that capital mix. But a very big opportunity is the secondary royalty space. So there are a lot of royalties which are sitting either within major mining companies or they're sitting in private equity hands, often generated as sweeteners to private equity deals, or from legacy corporate activity. Often someone will sell a project and retain a royalty, which over time as that matures, can be quite a valuable asset and they will look to monetize. So Trident's really nicely positioned to consolidate those assets. And as a shareholder, you make money. There's really four pillars to that growth proposition. Firstly, obviously, they have to do good deals. They would look, generally they talk about a circa 15% return as a base case on acquisitions. Over and above that, you're obviously hoping for organic growth through exploration and capital spend by the operators, but also commodity prices, which should go up over time as we've seen. But then your discount rate will lower over time. So if you buy that number 15, the market should value that at a lower discount rate, and that will then grow the share price. So that's quite powerful maths in your favor, if that goes right. It's got a very high quality board. The exec team is led by a gentleman called Adam Davidson. So he came out of the world's, I think, largest mining focused private equity house, which is Resource Capital Funds, and it's got a good team around him. And then recently they were joined as chairman by Paul Smith, who was the former head of strategy for Glencore. Very big ambitions in joining this company. He's also made a big personal investment in it. Another good quality non-execs, a gentleman called Al Gourley, who's one of the world's, I would say, most senior resources lawyers, big focus on royalties. Helen Payne, who's a very highly regarded geologist. And recently Peter Backus joined, who's a very well-known mining banker in our space. This is hopefully at the start of a journey of what could be quite a significant company. If they achieve the vision, it could become quite a go-to share, I would say, for institutions who want that commodity exposure in an equity format. We've got it currently trading at around 0.7 of its net asset value, which is a good price. As I say, if you can achieve scale, you can get a premium to MPV. So currently trading at 35p thereabouts, and we've got a target of 50p for the share.
Sounds very interesting. Moving on to your next pick.
So Shanta Gold. So this is more of a classic junior mining investment. It's a junior gold producer with a portfolio of projects behind. So, again, from a size perspective, this is an interesting point, I think, for an investor. It's sitting there just below $190 million market cap. So, it's most firmly on the institutional radar now and will attract more capital as it continues to grow. While it's a junior, it is a producer, so it's gone through, some of that risk profile with its first mine, which is a mine called Nyalowika, which is in Tanzania. That's a high-grade gold mine in Tanzania. Tanzania was a little bit out of favour with investors. Some people will have followed issues with what was Acacia before it was taken out by Barrick. That's turned around quite significantly now, including with political changes in Tanzania. So I think Tanzania's back in favour, and Shanta's quite well positioned there. So Luika is a good profitable mine. It'll do 60,000 to 65,000 ounces of gold this year at a reasonable cash cost. It's generally about an 80,000 ounces a year operation. So getting to be meaningful, and that provides good cash flow for the company. Actually underpins a small dividend. It's currently yielding around 1.5%. So you do get something of an income from this, which is quite unusual in the junior gold space. But you're really in it for the growth. So they are in the process of constructing their second mine, which is also in Tanzania. That's a mine called Singida. That'll take you to nicely over 100,000 ounces, which is a good threshold that people often look at. Singida is a relatively small operation, but quite a lot of upside there. There's a big inferred resource, which we think they can convert to a more substantial operation once they've delivered that production. But the one that really excites us with this is their project called West Kenya, which is a very high-grade gold project. They're currently sitting at 1.2 million ounces of gold at 12.6 grams a tonne. And that would be one of the highest-grade development projects globally. And that underpins really strong economics, as you'd expect. So they've got a published scoping study there, which has an NPV of around $340 million, very high IRR, 110%, which is clearly exceptional. That's at a gold price of $1,700 an ounce. Gold's now at around $1,800 an ounce. And at the moment, they're infill drilling that deposit. So there's been a whole succession of drill results coming through. One of them recently was one of the highest drill results reported anywhere globally this year. So we're looking for that resource to be upgraded and updated shortly, which will be a good catalyst for the stock. And if they can maintain or hopefully improve on those scoping study economics, that's going to be very positive for the share price. It should underpin a very profitable operation or potentially make the company a takeover target. So on that one, our combined target price, accounting for all of the assets, is 30p per share. The shares are currently at 13p, so that's good upside to be trading at that price to net present value for something that's already in production.
And why has the share price been drifting on that one? Is it the gold price?
There was a little bit of gold price. So the gold equities generally had a pullback over the last, say, 8 weeks, although that's now started to reverse as the gold price has come back over over 1,800. They did have a specific issue. So the reason why it'll produce 60,000 to 65,000 ounces here is that they hit an area in the mine at Luica, which was a lot lower grade than expected. So that caused them to re-look at that mine plan, and that's where the 60,000 to 65,000 ounces came from. The impact on the overall valuation of the company from a net present value perspective is certainly lower than was reflected in the share price. But of course, you know, a short-term hit to profits, you know, is always going to cause a little bit of a concern for people in that. That perhaps disproportionately knocked the share price back. But as I say, I think this is now probably quite a good buying opportunity as a result. What they did do was come out with a 5-year mine plan on the back of that. So you get quite good visibility now going forward.
Great. And I think your last pick is a picks and shovels type of play, isn't it?
That's right. So a service provider. So this is a classic picks and shovels play. So Capital Limited. So that's listed on the main board here. The ticker is CAPD. The company was actually previously known as Capital Drilling. It dropped the drilling in reflection of what is now a broader mining services offering. So they have the drilling business, which is production drilling, you know, also exploration drilling, but they also have now significant earth moving mining services business, and also a laboratory services business called MSA Labs, which is growing quite quickly, and hence the name change. So while it's a drilling business at its core, it's important to distinguish between exploration drilling and production drilling. Capital does both, but versus its peers, it's much more weighted towards the production drilling side. So that's grade control drilling, blast hole drilling. Now that's important because that is a more consistent business. You know, it's central to a mine's operation. So while they will benefit from the exploration cycle, they're not as volatile as a company which is maybe focused more or exclusively on exploration drilling, which is inherently shorter term contracts, more volatile business. So it's really underpinned by those long term contracts, and they're with people, companies the likes of Centamin, Barrick, really quite blue chip companies where they've operated in most cases for very long, a very long tenure. It's been listed since 2010. I think they've been drilling consistently, for example, at Centamin since that time. Now, a big pillar of the growth here, and the reason why I think this is particularly exciting, is this move into the earth moving business and other services such as labs. The strategy is really all about selling more services to those customers, and they've done that quite successfully. So the contract they recently won, or the extension or expansion of their contract at Centamin's Sukari mine, is by some distance the biggest contract that they've secured to date. And that's $235 to $260 million coming through over a 4-year period. And we don't think the market has really really grasped the impact of that. You know, it should generate on our numbers around $57 million of EBITDA this year. That's up from $34 million last year. So that's about a 2/3 increase. And they're only now just getting into the meat of that Sukari contract. So you've got pretty locked in earnings growth coming through there. The labs business is also growing very quickly. I think that was doing around $5 million of turnover last year. The CEO of Capital on a recent call, I think, heard him a figure of up to around $30 million potentially from that business alone in the next next year. So that's obviously a tremendous growth rate. And I think you get that growth at quite cheap multiples. It's trading at an EV/EBITDA currently on our numbers of 3.8, price earnings around eight times. Those multiples will certainly reduce next year as the growth comes through, and it pays a nice dividend, currently yielding a bit over 3%. And I would expect that to continue. The management team there are quite big shareholders still of Capital, and I'm sure we'll want to maintain quite strong payments. So that's a really nice services play.
It seems to be trading quite cheaply. Is that across the sector, or is there a case for why that is?
I think it trades at a bit of a discount to the sector. I think when we look at comps, you know, you might be looking at EV/EBITDA sort of north of five. So this trades at a discount to that as a forward-looking basis. I think that discount is stark. And I really think this is a case of, you know, a business which is growing quite rapidly. I think this mining services or earth moving growth, you know, hasn't really been factored in by the broader market. And as people do start to see those earnings come through H2 this year, H1 next year, I would expect this share price to continue to move.
Tremendous, Richard. Thank you very much indeed. Can you tell people where they can find you and your research?
Yeah, of course. So firstly, our research, that's all available through all of the usual aggregators. Obviously, Bloomberg, FactSet, and similar services. We do make it freely available, so anyone who subscribes to those services will be able to access it. You can also access it on the same basis through ResearchTree, which is a research distribution partner. It's also available for sophisticated investors through our website, which is tamasispartners.com. If you go there and are able to confirm your status as a sophisticated investor, you will find the research there. You can search by company. In terms of how to find us generally, in terms of social media channels, the one we're active on would be LinkedIn, so it's worth following there. We'll make material publications or at least flag them there, or anything particularly significant in terms of transactions we've worked on will be available there. Otherwise, contact details are on our website.
Many thanks, Richard, for a tremendous interview. And to all our listeners, you can find over 100 investor interviews like this at piworld.co.uk/education. And do subscribe to get a notification of a new video as it's published with no spam. And please leave comments, reviews, or like our videos and podcasts on the various platforms. It means a lot to us, and it keeps us motivated to continue producing this content. Many thanks for listening, and stay well. PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.